get my breath back. on to our next guest speaker. We have Professor Moira Sim, who's from the School of Nursing and Midwifery and Postgrad Medicine at ECU. Her clinical and research interests are in mental health, comorbid drug and alcohol issues, early prevention and health system development within the community. She works as a GP and has roles within the divisions of general practice in Australia at a local, state and national level. Moira coordinates programs for medical practitioners, nurses and other allied health professionals in a range of areas including preventative medicine, family medicine, geriatric medicine, palliative care, occupational medicine, health and safety, aviation medicine, and men's health and andrology. So please welcome Professor Moira Sim. Thank you, there you are.
Okay, first I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Noongar people. As said, my name is Moira. I'm a GP and also an addiction specialist, and I came from Malaysia when I was 13 years old. And when I came here, you know, people have talked about things that have happened in life. One of the defining things for me was coming in as a foreigner. And, you know, as a foreigner, I wasn't very cool. You know, these Chinese kids who, you know, hang around studying and, you know, doing those sorts of things. And I learnt very early that kids at school weren't terribly kind to people who were not cool. And those kids, you know, who were really cool, you know, did things like use drugs. So when I became a GP, I was actually quite scared of that group of people who use drugs. And so I decided I'd go and learn a bit about them. And so as a result, I ended up working for the Drug and Alcohol Office. Hello, Lee. and in there, I learnt about this technique called motivational interviewing, which a lot of drug counsellors use. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about this experience and about how I translate that into what I do every day as a GP. I don't claim to be an expert in motivational interviewing. I've gone and done a course with the original people, but I haven't done the long training where they've supervised me or anything like that. So what I'm talking about is a practical approach, and I think it's the spirit of MI that could be useful in terms of thinking about how you apply it where you work. So what's MI? There are lots of very clever definitions, but this is the definition I like best from Miller and Rolnick's work. It uses simpler language that I understand. A collaborative, person-centred way of guiding the patient to elicit and strengthen motivation for change. So you work with the person, it's centred on them, you guide them to strengthen their motivation for change. The goal is to increase their intrinsic motivation rather than to impose it from externally. Not what I think as a doctor, but what they think as the person who owns that body. It involves a blend of informing, asking, listening, to evoke the patient's own values, goals, insights, motivations, and resources for change. Now, again, I don't have great expertise in working with Aboriginal people. In my real life, I have not come across that many Aboriginal people in my clinical work. As you know, hospitals aren't exactly friendly places. And in my general practice, you know, there's only a very few Aboriginal people. I think I have 3 patients who are Aboriginal. And most of them are the very successful people who are very well integrated into life here. So apart from my student days, I don't have much exposure to the Aboriginal people who are out in the northwest or who find it difficult to access the health system. But it seems to me in that third point, it is a very respectful way of working. And what I know about Aboriginal people, it's actually very, very important that if we want to work with them on health, that is respectful, that this is collaborative, that while I might have studied and therefore have knowledge which is useful in terms of informing, it is that collaborative way of working with them that is the most likely to get somewhere. So, underlying this concept of MI, there is this concept of ambivalence. Ambivalence is something that is known to all of us, right? I know, because I studied long years to know, that, you know, those vegetables are very good for me. They have really good vitamins and all sorts of antioxidants and fibre and all the rest of it. But, you know, I don't really get excited about them the way I do when I open a box of Lindt chocolate. Don't know about you, but That's the thing about ambivalence, isn't it? There are the things we know we should do, and then there are the things that, you know, we also want at the same time. And ambivalence goes into almost everything that we do. We're ambivalent about getting up to go to work, about getting up early in the morning to go for that walk, to eat or not to eat, to leave somebody or not to leave them, to bite back or not to bite back, and so on, okay? So ambivalence is a normal human condition, and it's normal for people to get stuck in ambivalence. When we think about how we are ambivalent about all sorts of things, it makes it just that little bit easier to understand things that seem very difficult to understand. You know, you and I might look at somebody who's throwing their life away by using heroin or some woman who's staying with this man who's obviously very bad for her, and you think, why can't you see? But from their point of view, just like I might have that issue about, you know, the chocolates or whatever, there is this sense of ambivalence. There are the good things and the not so good things about everything. So, but we as health professionals, because we know what people are supposed to do for their health, it can be very frustrating. It can feel like you're banging your head against the brick wall. So, that's where motivational interviewing comes in. One of the things I noticed when I was working with these amazing drug counsellors, you know, looking at people that other people might say, oh God, you know, how can you work with them? You know, they're just so frustrating. The thing is that their goals were a bit different. They didn't have the view that I grew up in my medical training with, this is where you've got to get people to go. Their goals were about working with people in a different way, and that made it less frustrating for them. So, because I've only got a short session and because I know that we were running late, I'm not going to go through any of these exercises, so you can breathe your sigh of relief. But I'm going to get you to imagine we had done this exercise. Okay. So what I would have done was to get you to pair up and do this thing, to think about something that you wanted to change but you weren't quite ready to change. Okay. Like maybe eat that little bit less or something. But something that you weren't quite ready to. And then you would have had to sort of talk to the person next to you. Okay, and one person had to try and do this. So ideally, of course, I would have got you to not pick something too confidential. Okay, one of you would have had to be the helper, and I would have asked you to say, find out what the other person is thinking about changing. Just a quick question, find out what it is, okay? So the issue might be, I don't know, I want to exercise in the morning. And then the other person has to say, give three specific benefits that would result in that person, that would result from that person making the change. So if you started exercising in the morning, then you would feel better and, you know, you would have more energy and you'd lose weight. Give suggestions as to how you'd make the change. Well, you can put your alarm clock in, you know, early in the morning and put three alarm clocks and you could get your husband to wake you up and, you know, you could just write yourself lots of notes and make yourself do it. Emphasise how important it is to make the change. Well, you know, it's really, really important because if you don't do this, you know, you're going to die of a heart attack and, you know, it's going to be all your fault. And persuade the person to do it. Come on, you really got to do it. Blah, 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 right? And if you meet resistance, repeat all the above, because if she goes, but, you go, blah, 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 right? Now, this is a parody, but we do that, don't we? In some settings, we do, right? What happens in that sort of interview? You turn off. Right? What else? Sorry? So you're more reluctant to do it, you mean? Yes, so you're more kind of, no, I refuse to do it because you're giving me the whatchamacallits. Right? Okay. What else? So if I say to you, look, you've got a da-da, what goes in your head?
It's imposed on you.
It's imposed on me and I don't like it. So what goes on in your head? I'm not doing it. I refuse to do it. I'm getting more and more resistance against it. And when I say to you, look, you could put an alarm clock in the morning. Sorry to pick on you because you're at the front. You could put an alarm clock in the morning and, you know, you could put three alarm clocks in the morning. What would you say? What's going on in your head when I say that?
You only need one.
So you stupid woman, I only need one. Or you might start to say, well, you know, alarm clocks won't damn well work for me, will they? Or whatever. So you start actually arguing with me, don't you? Okay. So, by the way, this isn't motivational interviewing, just in case you walk away thinking that's what it was, okay? So, when you do that exercise, you find that people get more resistant, right? And they actually work against you. Having said that, does that bit of that approach sometimes work? Yeah, of course it does. There's actually good evidence that health professionals who actually say to people, this thing called brief intervention, where you identify an issue and you say, look, you know, it'd be a really good idea to do whatever, that people do listen to you. The problem is, it's a minority of people who listen to you and a lot of people who don't quite do it. And so you walk away feeling like you're bashing your head against a brick wall. Because, you know, for instance, saying to people, look, you know, it's a good idea to stop smoking. How many people will stop after that one intervention? Anything from 3 to 5%, depending on how much material and extra stuff you give them, right? So that's 19 out of 20, at least, who don't listen to you, apparently, that time. So you walk away feeling like your head's pretty bruised. But from a public health perspective, is what you're doing important? Of course it is, because that 1 out of 20 is huge, okay? But we need something for the 19 out of 20, don't we? Okay, so we need more. What happens is that we have this thing, as health professionals, we've been trained to teach people to do this. And the person's ambivalence is kind of at the other side. And what happens is a bit of a boxing match. And the more I say, you got to do this, the more they go opposite. So think about the continuum of styles that we use. There is this style that's more authoritarian directing, which at times we need to do, and there is more the style where you just follow wherever the person wants to go, whatever they want to do. And obviously there are times when one style is more appropriate, isn't it? So for instance, when you need to teach somebody how to go on warfarin, you know, that drug that thins your blood, and you know, which you have to, has to be extremely carefully controlled so you don't make someone bleed to death, you don't say to someone, do you feel like taking warfarin? What time do you would you think, you know, would be a good time to take it? What time would you like to, you feel you'd like to take it? How much do you feel like taking? No, because you might kill a few people on the way, right? So you ain't going to do that. Then there is the time when people need a bit of encouragement to exercise. Well, that's probably a little bit of halfway, isn't it? Some of your information and some helpful hints may be helpful, but being able to guide them so that they come up with the ideas might also be very helpful. Then there's the other side where someone comes in and bursts into tears because it's a relationship problem. Well, obviously, it's not exactly ethical for you to be directive at that point, is it? It's really where they're going in their life. So, you know, there are times when you'll go right the other end and you're going to be directed by them, okay? So the spirit of MI is collaborative, so you share the power. It's evocative. You get the desires and the ideas on what to do from the patient. And at all times, it respects autonomy. It respects the right not to change, which is sometimes quite difficult, I think, because sometimes I also know that, you know, it's my duty to make people change, okay? And having to move that can also be a bit of a stretch. But I often think with that it's an issue of developing a relationship. And with that relationship, if I can respect the autonomy over time, I can shift people. Because I can still have my plan in mind. It's a bit like when you're a mother and you know what your children should do. Sometimes you can tell your kids things, and sometimes you know when you have to keep quiet and let them learn from themselves. So why is this important? Why is this global, you know, why is this spirit so important? Because independent researchers have actually shown that you can measure the degree of collaboration in the therapist's speech, the degree to which they get the patient to say what they want, and the degree of autonomy, as in how much they show respect for what the patient wants to do, that when they do a global rating of this, by independent people who weren't in the interview and don't know what the outcomes are, that predicts the patient's behaviour change. So respecting, being collaborative, and drawing from the patient actually changes their behaviour. Coming back to ambivalence, because this is a really key thing here. We talk about... Oh, sorry, I cut all these slides out and I didn't actually... I cut out this slide about Miller and Rolnick. I should actually mention, of course, Miller and Rolnick are the people who developed this. Sorry, I was trying to keep the talk short. Okay. So they talk a great deal about ambivalence carrying the seeds of motivation. that when you come across somebody who's ambivalent, instead of thinking, oh no, you know, this is really hard because they're ambivalent, ambivalence is actually the seed from which something grows. So it's actually fantastic when people are ambivalent, because that actually is the beginning of them wanting to change. So when someone's ambivalent, the idea is not to focus on the behaviour change, but to focus on understanding their dilemma and their ambivalence. Don't be the one arguing for change, because if you argue, they will argue back, and then they will be arguing against change. You evoke the patient's own argument for change, and you encourage realistic beliefs that change is possible. So everything about the technique, if you like, you know, the Miller and Rolnick don't like talking about it as a technique. They think about it as more of an approach, because it's not the kind of thing where you say there are these exact questions and you follow the script. It's about that spirit. And I think when you think about it that way, when you work in Aboriginal communities, it that allows you to be much more able to work within what you know of the people that you work with and the language that feels comfortable to you and is appropriate for that setting. So what I would have done at this point is made you go through the exercise again, and this time we're going to use a different approach, okay? So this time the idea would be to say, you're going to listen with interest. So you find out what it is the person wants to change and you go, my goal is to understand the dilemma, okay? Not to change the behaviour now. So I will make sure I give no advice whatsoever. And so then I ask four questions. I go, why are you considering this change? So if you think about, if you were thinking about changing and someone said to you, why are you considering this change? What sort of things would you come out with? What sort of statements would you come out with? Positives towards that change. So you would actually start to argue why it's a good idea for you to change, right? And if I then said, if you want it to succeed, how might you go about doing it? What sort of statements would you come out with? Good ideas on how to make that change, wouldn't you? And they would be good ideas based on understanding your life, not mine. Because I might think that, I don't know, an alarm clock works. You might hate alarm clocks. So you would actually come out with something that might work in your real life, unlike me, stupid person who doesn't understand your life, trying to give you advice that doesn't fit. And you might say, what are the three best reasons to do this? So I'm picking the real reasons that are the most important to you, isn't it? You know, it's that thing where we get our messages wrong sometimes, don't we? Like if you want to say to a young person, you know, don't smoke because it'll give you cancer. You know, cancer only happens to really old people, like people over 30, right? Over the hill, you know, that sort of thing. So it doesn't make sense, does it? It's to a 14-year-old. Or for that matter, I mean, you know, who was that? What was that health promotion message they did where they said smoking was deadly? You know, so sometimes we can get it really wrong if we don't understand where people are coming from. So they come out with their three best reasons. And I always make sure I write down those things, because that's the thing I will come back to, because I know that's what's important to them. On a scale of 0 to 10, how important is this change to you? And then whatever number they come out with, and I've never heard anybody say 0, I go, why so high? Why not 0? And then what happens is that they will argue why they should make that change. So all the time, all these questions are about making them say why they want to change, how they can change, how it will be successful. Okay? And then you summarise. So I then, you know, whatever it is that the person says, I summarise it and I say, so, you know, you like drinking because it helps you relax when you come home, but, and you know, you it's something to do and you get a bit bored at night, but, you know, you're getting a bit worried about, you know, the fact that it's getting to your memory and you're spending lots on alcohol and you know, you don't like the fact that your wife's giving you a hard time over this now, and you know she's really worried about, you know, you becoming sick like her father, and you can really understand that, so you feel really guilty every time you drink. And I summarise that stuff, and in my summary what I'm doing is I'm kind of showing, first that I understand, two that I'm kind of showing the negatives, saying back the negatives in a way that person might not have heard. But because I've said what they've said, it becomes really important. Because, you know, we're funny people. When we say something, it's very important. When other people say something, we're not very good at listening. So if you have heard and you can summarise back what that person has just said to you, it's more likely to get in because they said it. And you're taking their words and giving it back to them. And they go, wow, I didn't realise, you know. And so then you throw it back and you go, what do you think you'll do? And you just listen, okay? So you can see this is a very different approach, isn't it? It's an approach which is collaborative, is evocative, it gets them to talk, and at the same time you're not trying to push them, therefore you are respecting their autonomy here, okay? So it's a very different role to what I know I was brought up to do. And the idea I often have to struggle with is to say, look, I don't have to make the change happen because I can't anyway. I'm not that powerful. And you don't have to come up with all the answers because you probably don't have the best ones. They do. And so the idea that, you know, you're not wrestling, you're dancing. And in Tori Zamoyer's at that workshop that I went to in the States with Miller and Rolnick, she did this lovely thing where she said, look, you know, when you're dancing, you know, if you're the leading partner, you kind of move around, don't you? If somebody kind of says they don't want to go there, you move. You see an obstacle along the way, you move. But all the time, you know where you're going to go. So the fact that you go forward and back and around, etc., doesn't matter because eventually you know that's where you want to go. So as a health professional, you know where you're going to go, but you'll do this respectfully, working with them as you go. I like that concept. So MI actually got developed years ago when Miller and Rolnick were working with problem drinkers. And what they were doing at the time that they did this, you know, the prevailing belief was that, you know, with alcoholics, sorry, I always pick on people at the front, you know, they used to say, admit you're an alcoholic. You've got to stand up and say, I'm an alcoholic, otherwise you will never get cured, right? That's what people believed you had to do at the time, right? And when they first started doing the research on motivational interviewing, the people that they were doing this kind of approach was, they didn't really think it was a therapy. They were just giving them some, you know, exercises where they said, look, here's a book you can go off and read by yourself and, you know, have a think about what you want to do yourself kind of thing. And they actually found, oh, my God, the control group's done just as well as the group that we had all this intensive, you know, admit you're an alcoholic. So that started them actually thinking through, you know, how this accident might turn out to be something. So I'll just show you one piece of research, and this is what they did. They randomised people into two groups, people who were drinking too much alcohol. And one group had to have that confrontational, directive one, and the other one, they had this motivational, reflective way of dealing with them. And they made sure that it wasn't the therapist, because they made the therapist also get randomised. So the therapist had to sometimes be directive and sometimes had to be motivational, reflective. And they actually found that when you confront people, you have higher resistance. I will not change because I'm sick of you telling me what to do, right? And they're less likely to acknowledge their problem. And when people are resistant, they're less likely to change in the long term. So since then, there's been MI after MI study, and this is just a systematic review done by Rubach in 2005. They've used, so this is where they pull together all the randomised control trials, and they say, look, MI has been used in lots of different areas, so not just with drug and alcohol issues, smoking cessation, weight loss, physical activity, you know, diabetes treatment, etc., all sorts of things, even criminal activity, okay? About people doing stuff to get themselves back to jail. And basically it's been done by, you know, people in all sorts of different professions, and in the majority of the trials, the MI outperformed traditional advice. And they used all sorts of clinical measures that you know, like blood pressure and cholesterol and things like that. And one of the things I thought was interesting was that they also found that it was the number of encounters rather than how long you spent with people. So you don't have to spend 3 hours with somebody in a deep counselling thing. You know, the fact that you work in a community and you get to know people and they get to know you, you might even see them for short periods of time, but it's actually having that relationship and continuing to see people that gives you the greater opportunity. So they talk about MI as being something that's particularly useful when people are resistant or ambivalent. And they also talk about this concept of, you know, when you talk about motivation, there's this way that we tend to think of, you know, oh, that's an unmotivated person, you know, she's just always unmotivated. But, you know, the thing is that people are unmotivated for one thing, but they could be very motivated for something else, couldn't they? So I might be very motivated I might be unmotivated to stop heroin, but I could be very motivated to continue using heroin, couldn't I? And I could be incredibly, incredibly resourceful and clever when it comes to wanting to do what I'm committed to doing, okay? So we're all different, but, you know, our motivation depends on what it is that matters to us. But it also depends on how I get on with the person in front of me. Like one of you just said, you know, if I just keep on going on and on at you, you might go, I don't want to. So when somebody is not motivated, it's a reason for us to think, well, am I doing something that makes the person want to come up against me? What should I be doing differently that might just make them shift? So resistance and denial is a signal to modify what we're doing. So where does am I come in? Most of you probably know about that cycle of change, don't you? I've just made it into a line, right? You think about this as healthcare workers, we are very, very good at doing the helping people change once they're ready to. Once people say, that's what I want to do, we've all been very well trained at doing it, right? What we're not so good in is when somebody's not interested in change, that's where motivational comes in, okay? And helping them prepare for change, strengthening their commitment. So these are the principles. We talked about the three things about the spirit, the collaborative, evocative, autonomous. Now, these are the strategies. One is to basically get on with people, be empathetic, right? And that you got to connect with people. The second, and the reason is, of course, people like to do things for people they like, don't you? You want people to like you. You want to get on with them. You want them to work with you, right? The second thing is to develop discrepancy. And this is why it's so important to understand where people come from. Because when you understand where people come from, you can draw a discrepancy between what's happening and what they want. So, for example, I might say that, you know, I want to grow up. I want to watch my grandchildren grow up. That's really important to me because my family is really important to me. And you might be worried about how much I'm smoking and you think I'm going to have another heart attack really soon. And so you could actually draw that discrepancy and say, you know, your family's really important to you and you want to watch your grandchildren grow up. But, you know, with this diabetes and the smoking, it's kind of doesn't kind of go together with that, does it? Because, you know, diabetes and smoking will probably mean that, you know, you'll have a heart attack pretty soon. And that might mean that you get really sick and you might not even live to see your family. You could actually draw that discrepancy between, or if somebody says, I really like heroin, but I really hate the fact that, you know, I've got no money and my mum hates me and nobody will talk to me anymore, etc. So you draw the discrepancy. You like heroin, but you really hate the stuff that goes with it, okay? And then the next thing you do is you amplify the ambivalence, because what you do, when you identify that somebody has this problem, this ambivalence, you make it sound bigger. You throw it back to them and you ask them, you show it to them that they want this and they want this, and you amplify the difference between them. By doing that, what you do is you make people feel uncomfortable, don't you? Because then they kind of have to say, I don't know, maybe I have to do something. So that's what you do, and you try and do that respectfully, gently, using what they tell you as much as possible. Try and use only what they tell you. And then if you want to add anything else, you can, as a health professional, be respectful and say, can I tell you a little bit about, you know, what diabetes means? Diabetes, can I tell you a little bit about my concerns about your health? And if they say yes, which most people would if you ask respectfully, you can draw that discrepancy and that ambivalence. So you make them think, okay? And then if the idea of rolling with resistance, what this is about is that if somebody says something that basically says, I don't want you to go there, if you go there, what you will do is increase their resistance. So what you want to do is step aside and go somewhere else, like we talked about with the dance thing. So an example of what I mean is, let's say I say, look, you know, look, you got to stop smoking, because if you don't stop smoking, you know, this is going to kill you. This is really bad for you. Oh, God, not another person. You know, everyone's going to go but my smoking. You go, who's having a go at your smoking? And it's like, my wife. My wife's always having a go. What's she worried about? And, you know, and if, well, you know, because her father died from a stroke and, you know, the doctors told her it was because of smoking. So she worries about you, does she? So you can talk. You see how there's no more resistance? He's talking about that. You can actually then start to say, so do you worry about it too? And maybe you might get someone starting to say, well, maybe I do. Yeah? It's that conversation by not going head on. You roll with resistance. You go around and you don't fight. Okay? And the last one is to support self-efficacy. In everything that you do, especially when you know people, you can often say things that are positive that support self-efficacy, like, I know you're really strong because I saw what you did when you went through that terrible thing a few years ago. And, you know, you were the one who held the family up. So I know when you want to do things, you can do it. So in everything you say, you support what they can do. And you do all this by using open-ended questions, not telling people as much as possible, asking them, you know, what's important to you? What do you think, you know, what does diabetes mean to you? You affirm as much as you can everything that you know about them, and you reflect all the time. Whatever they tell you, you reflect it back to them, and you summarise. When you summarise, then what happens is that you will be giving them back what they have said in a way that is packaged up. So when you listen and reflect, people will come up with two types of talk. They will have what you call change talk, where I say, for example, I say, oh, it's time I stopped drinking. That's change talk, because I'm saying I want to change. Or if I say, I'll never be able to stop, it's too hard. That's sustained talk. I'm saying I'm not going to change. It's too hard. Okay? So you listen out for what people are saying. And when people are saying change talk, what you want to do is to grow that. Whatever they say, you ask, you say, tell me more about that, okay? So that they start to say more about the change talk. And why that's important is therapists that do this affirm support, you know, with that autonomy, they get people to do more change talk. And when you get more change talk, you get better outcomes. And so you want people to say the kind of thing where they say, I want, I wish, I'd love to. You want them to say, I can, I could. You want them to say, because, I need to, this is why. You want them to say, I must, I need, it's important, I really have to. And you want them, most of all, to commit, to say, I'm going to, all right? Or I'll think about it. Even that's a little bit of a commitment. So when you think about that second exercise that you nearly did, what you were asking them when you say, why are you considering this change, is you're trying to get their desire. When you, if you said, if you wanted to succeed, how might you go about it? You were getting them to talk about their ability. If you said, what are your three best reasons? You're getting their deep reasons. And you say, you know, on a scale of 0 to 10, how important it is, you're actually getting the need to change from them. You summarize, and in that you reflect their motivation for change. And then when you say, what do you think you'll do? You're asking for their commitment. All of this is going to be available after the PowerPoint, and I've also done a handout which will be available for you. So in MI, it's actually quite directive because you will ask eliciting questions, and you try not to ask questions that ask people to give you the barriers to change. You don't go, why is this so hard for you? Because then, you know, I'll go, well, you know, it's really, really hard because I don't want to and blah, 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 and then spend all my time telling you why I don't want to change and walk away with that ringing in my head. What you want is to ask me the questions that get me saying, yeah, I really want to change, so that I walk away hearing that in my head, okay? So you selectively reflect, selectively elaborate, ask for more whenever somebody tells you. When you hear them doing some change talk, you go, tell me more about that. But when they say, give you barriers, you don't go, tell me more about that. You don't want to get them to focus on that, okay? You summarize and you affirm. Okay. Resistance worsens outcomes, so you don't want people to go down resistance track. When they say anything resistant, you sidestep, listen, empathize more. You don't want to get them to talk about that too much. So the three things people need to have in their mind in order to change, they got to believe it's no good here. Yeah, you're going to cross the river, you got to believe this side of the river is no good. And then you got to believe that it's better on the other side, and you got to believe that you can get there, that there's a way of getting over there. Because if you think there's no way, there's no point. Like, you know, you tell me I've got diabetes, everybody I know who's diabetes just dies, so there's no point in me doing anything about it, right? So you need to actually listen, work with them slowly so they understand the information, take it on board, and they've got to believe that if they make that change, you see, you can be like her over there. She's got diabetes and she's healthy. You know, you've got to have a reason to believe it's bad here, it's good there, and I can get over there. And that's what you want to get them saying. So traps for us, we've got to try to avoid the writing reflex where we tell people all the time. And remember, you don't have to have a change plan. You don't have to sort everything out. You don't have to sort things out today. Time and actually having a relationship with people is on your side. And so what you do all the time is you summarise and you hand it back. You test the water all the time with a summary. You go, what will you do now? What now? Where does that leave you? Whatever words make sense to you, but it's about throwing back and respecting where they want to go. Okay, I'm just going to quickly race through some final diagrams. This, I'll give you some references to this so you can actually go to the publications where it's from. So this is from a diagram where you can kind of talk about the building motivation is like going uphill. It's that hard work in the beginning. Once they get to the point where they have got to the top of the hill and they're ready to do it, it becomes easy. Then you can go into all the advice that you are used to doing because that's what's needed then. People talk about that cycle of change. What I've done is there's a ladder of change here, and I'm showing that with motivational interviewing, which is on the right, that you use it most when people are not ready to change. Once people are ready to change, you don't need motivational interviewing. Just do what you normally do. Okay? And brief intervention, where you tell people what to do, that works better a little bit higher up. This is a short little thing that I will often use when I'm in a bit more of a rush. You know, in general practice, I often don't have that much time, so I might kind of go, what do you like about whatever it is, and what don't you like about it? So what don't you like about your smoking? And then I might add my own concerns. And then I go, where does that leave you? And I summarise. Okay. And then there's this other question you can ask where that thing of a 0 to 10. I'll tell you a very brief story about this one where they was looking after this guy who was on the methadone program for a long, long time. And I'd been trying really hard to get him to stop smoking and blah, blah. And, you know, he just wouldn't move, right? And I thought, fine, respect autonomy, do nothing. Just keep seeing him, etc. Then one day, you know, I'm running late and he wanted to talk about something else. And we're going, no, I'm going, oh, I'm running late. I've got my hand on the door ready to kind of shoo him out, you know, being nice, but, I've got to get on. And he says, he puts his hand on the other side of the door and he goes, there is one more thing. And he goes, I've decided it's time to stop smoking. And I go, oh, I have to deal with this today. I have to deal with this. I thought, oh, what can I do? So I said, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you want to? And he said, 7. And I said, okay, what are the 3 best reasons why you want to stop? He said, because I'm spending too much money. I know it's really bad for my health. And I know this is just going nowhere. And this is, you know, I'm just coughing and this is really bad for me. I said, okay. You promise me you'll make an appointment on Monday, will you? He said, yes, I will. So I did that in about 10 seconds. Did he stop smoking? Yes, he did. He did. And then he started again. 6 months later, I did the same thing again. But the thing is that, you know, that approach can be used over a period of time in that 10-second conversation, you know. So you don't have to do the long, long thing to be able to get there, okay? So you can use these sorts of tools, which I won't go into great detail. Again, that's in the handout, okay? So Millane Rolnick recently wrote this thing to say what MI is not, because MI has now gone everywhere around the world. They decided not to copyright the term, so people have developed all sorts of MI that is a bit different to what they did. And they just wanted to say to people, look, it's not a way of tricking people into doing what you want them to do. It's not ethical to use it for anything other than, you know, you're obviously, as a health professional, you know, you're trying to promote health. It's not just a technique. It's that spirit is really important. It's not a decisional balance where you go pros and cons, because you kind of know where you want to go. It's you want to improve the health. It's not just an assessment feedback where you say, you know, tell us about your alcohol and then I just give it to you. You're trying to go somewhere with it. It's not CBT, but you can do CBT with it. It's not just client-centered therapy where you're just going in that whichever direction they want. And most of all, it's not a panacea. It doesn't do everything. but it's an approach that can be helpful. And I suspect there's a lot of really good work that needs to be done about how you use that approach with Aboriginal people in a, you know, good, respectful language. And it needs some people who actually work with those settings. And if anybody is interested in that, come talk with me. I'd love to talk with you about it. So the final slide is there just some resources that are worth going to. And I particularly recommend that second one, which is Rolnick is the second author of Motivational Interviewing, and he's working in the UK where he's written stuff that you can use in fairly sort of mainstream settings, you know, not drug and alcohol settings, and good language, I think, you know, that you can use for every day. And Rolnick also does a lot of, or did a lot of work in South Africa where he was working with people with HIV, you know, fairly resilient population, but with not much in terms of resources. And so, you know, you look at some of those stories and you go, oh, what's the point of trying to make changes when they've got nothing? But he did some amazing work with them. And then the next two are some articles that I've done, and you'll see the diagrams in that. And if you're interested in a book, I really recommend that last one as well. That's it.
Get two questions if anyone's got any. just quickly, as Maura did mention, there is a information sheet and a booklet, and you can actually get those on the way out on the front desk. Okay, just for those that would like to get a copy. So thank you, Maura, for that enthusiastic talk and sharing your knowledge and tips for possible ways, any way to create change. Yeah, therefore, if you could come back up here. On behalf of the conference organisers, we'd like to thank you for sharing your time with us. Thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thanks.